Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Everybody, and welcome back to the Chilluminati podcast, episode 160. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by the Chris Tucker and Jackie Chan of LA, Alex and Jesse.
I'm Chris Tucker, aren't I? Oh, man. That's cool. I'm fine with it. I just wish I had Jackie Chan powers. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't want any
Jackie
trouble.
Jackie Chan has a hole in his head, so like, it's all right.
I saw all three of those movies. I'm very excited for the next one. They're working on a new one.
Knock over that vase, and if I have a rolled up newspaper, you better watch the fuck out. And don't think that I can't jump through a tiny little mail slot.
Shimon
because
Lee?
I can.
Shimon Lee. Yeah.
Camel's hump.
Yeah. Are we excited for the new Rush Hour movie, by the way, gentlemen?
Did you raise your hand because it's the only movie franchise that you've ever seen every entry in?
God, there's a new Rush Hour since when?
Lord of the Rings and Star Wars don't count.
I'm trying to think of another full franchise I've seen front to back. A full franchise.
Everybody's seen Lord of the Rings and Star Wars. Those don't count.
God damn it. Damn it. I was gonna say like Alien, but I've only seen Alien and Aliens, and I didn't go past that. Terminator, I've seen Terminator 1 and 2, and then I didn't go past that.
We so got him, kids. Not, we got him, boys.
Shit, this got, you know, I'll think of it. Air Bud? No, I haven't seen all the Air Buds.
Got him, like, boys. Why would you even watch all the Air Buds? Why is that the next one you went to?
I'm thinking of franchises that maybe
Indiana
I have
Jones
seen.
Kind of doesn't count either.
I have seen the Indiana Jones though, so if that, but if that doesn't count, then that's.
I would also say the Godfather doesn't count, but I know that you haven't.
Yeah, I was gonna say I haven't seen any Godfathers, so I have never seen them.
Okay,
all right. Well, I'm gonna think on that while Alex takes it away.
Because I've been googling if there's another Rush Hour movie. That's not true.
There's a fourth Rush Hour. Yeah,
no,
they're working on one, are they not?
That's what I heard. Am I wrong? Did it die in COVID?
I swear, I just. January 21st, 2022, Rush Hour 4, what we know so far.
Can I tell you what's crazy about this? So I'm on IMDb, and it says the only person attached, there's two people, Chris Tucker and the writer. And I was like, what did the writer do? What has the writer done?
That's barely Rush Hour at that point.
Here's the crazy thing. Yeah. Here's the crazy thing.
The plots aren't what's keeping me there.
Has written
Rush Hour
as first off, this is insane, has written... Only the Rush Hour movies.
What else
and
is there?
The Rush Hour TV show. And
there was a
potentially
Rush
Hour,
TV
Rush Hour 4.
Yeah.
And what's even crazier, uncredited script revisions. This is madness. These three movies, uncredited. One, Star Trek First Contact. Two, Cliffhanger. Three, Universal Soldier.
This guy wrote Mathis's childhood. Single-handedly wrote Mathis's childhood.
Are you the writer? Or is that what we're learning?
It was me.
It's crazy.
That's why the only movies I've seen are the ones I've worked on.
He's just super method. That's why he hasn't watched any movies.
I can't get into it. You know, ruin my creative process.
His rule of watching movies is if Lee and Carter haven't seen the movie, neither has he.
I've seen. There was something. It's gone.
What? That's how it. That's how it always goes.
Yeah,
there was something there for a minute.
Welcome back to part three of the first of several JFK episodes I'm going to be doing this year. Welcome back.
It's gonna be like 10 parts, everybody.
Don't
just like this is gonna be.
Don't think about
a
that right
journey.
Now. Don't think about that right now. If for some reason this is your first time listening to the show, first of all, welcome. Go back and listen to the first parts of this episode so you don't get lost. And second of all, patreon.com/IlluminatiPod isn't just the only place where you can spend money that directly supports the continued production of this fine show you're listening to right now. It's also literally descending into the basement of the Dallas police station and delivering a single 38 caliber bullet of value straight to an accused presidential assassin's abdomen in the form of fresh minisodes after every full ad-free episode. Early access to the Illuminati Presents Rotten Popcorn, our all-new lawsuit-free movie commentary show, bespoke monthly digital posters, a regular drip feed of free Illuminati shirts, and much, much more. It's a full-fledged government-sanctioned conspiracy of savings. Patreon.com/IlluminatiPod. It's there.
A government-sanctioned conspiracy of savings? There's never been such a thing. There's never there in the now. History of government has there been such a thing.
No one can see this, but Jesse is completely shrouded in darkness for today's like get together calling. And I don't know, man, you might be the government sanctioned agent that allows for such
things. He looks like a whistleblower. He looks like a whistleblower right now. No joke. Anyway.
Wait. Before you go that far, I'm going to steal it from you. Two things that I want to push forward. Hey, because of you guys, Rotten Popcorn, the show, there's six episodes on Patreon. But now we have a full-on public RSS feed where we'll be uploading one episode a month. The Mothman Prophecies was uploaded recently.
That was so long ago.
To our main feed. There will be no more Rotten Popcorn episodes on our main feed. It was just to let you guys know, hey, that's out there.
Can I ask a question? Can I just say a thing?
Yeah, you can.
I know during that first episode, we didn't know what to call it. And for a few episodes after, we didn't know what to call it. And the two of you took some time. And he thought about what to call it. And then he said, we're going to call it Rotten Popcorn. I went to go look at the comments in that first one. And every comment is like, I was confused because there's another show called Rotten Popcorn that I really enjoy. And I thought that was an episode of that.
Oh, no, there's another Rotten Popcorn.
That's our tradition. So don't worry about it. That's there one of the things.
No matter
that's
what one you of the do, Illuminati. You here's what you need to learn from the internet. No matter what you try to do, someone has already done it.
So what am I supposed to do?
Here's what we do. We'll do what we did last time. Wait it out and do nothing. And it'll just go away.
It worked out at least once for us. Yeah. It's true. But hey, once a month we'll be uploading. Go subscribe to that RSS feed. You guys can go listen to it for free now.
The only show called Rotten Popcorn at Illuminati
on the internet.
Yep.
Also, go to theyeti.com/Illuminati. We sold out of Mothman plushes, the first wave of 500 in 12 hours. They were just gone.
What's wrong with
you? So they're
people?
All up for pre-order now. They're working on the second wave of them. So if you want to guarantee yourself a Mothman plush, go to theyeti.com/Illuminati and go get yourself pre-ordered for one now so that when they all come out again, you have one. And you don't have to wait for wave three.
And
you love it.
The best part is you can bring them to shows and we'll definitely sign them for you and ruin
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Have right you guys on the seen forehead. All the pictures of Mothman plush, like traveling the world from all the people who just like have it out there? It's I good. Can't believe it's some good stuff.
I can't believe how much people love that little fucker.
He's so adorable.
He makes such an awful sound. It makes such an awful sound for how pretty he is.
Is that the upgrade? Next time we do a Mothman plush, we get the call. You squeeze
Mothman,
his little wing.
Mothman Build-A-Bear?
Mm-hmm.
You can hug him there and you it could be like, Oswald couldn't possibly have acted alone. Jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
Get one of four conspiracy sayings with your Mothman.
Yeah. And then the one like junk prize is me just like, that's not real.
Not even the Mothman is real.
There,
go back to sleep.
Yeah, it's just,
stop dreaming.
Instead of a Mothman, one in 12 people gets a Jesse plush. It's like, that's not real.
Just with a Illuminati t-shirt on.
It's the exact same thing, except it's just flesh colored.
HD texture of your face wrapped over the front of it. With wings coming out the back. That's like would be a Jesse merch from like 2015.
That's not real.
All right, that's all I had, Alex. You can take it back now.
Anyway, just like last time, we're going to continue winding our way through They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK by Governor Jesse Ventura. And it's not a good book, again, but it does work as
he's
a great
not a good
little,
man,
no.
And you should not take
anything
he says.
I'm not
going to
say he's not
says.
A good man. I'm just going to say this book is not, like, almost every link leads to a broken YouTube video link. Like, almost every citation in the book leads to, like, something
that
is no longer
available.
Are you telling
me that most of the stuff in the book is based off of YouTube?
I had to go through great pains to like backdoor verify every quote that I put in this goddamn book. It's fucking crazy. It's fucking, well, I probably did more work than he did in writing the book.
Honestly, the setup has been great. Episode one of JFK was really just kind of the facts. And then as episode two and now episode three, as we go into the Jesse Ventura stuff, it gets crazier and crazier and crazier.
Are you in the future somehow? Because this is still episode one, baby. Oh, it's still episode one. Don't forget.
Listen, for the sake of our listeners, this is part three.
For the sake of me, I promise you, this is only episode one.
I don't even know what that means.
Last time we finished by talking about Jack Ruby knowing Oswald before killing him and his possible CIA and mob connections. But before we get back to it, here's a little disclaimer. John F. Kennedy was a real person and his assassination was a real act of violence. Therefore, we're going to be discussing some seriously disturbing imagery and subject matter throughout the course of this series. This was the high profile murder of a sitting U.S. president. Videos and pictures you Google after listening to this may disturb you, so proceed with caution. It also happens to be one of the most notorious moments in world history, and therefore it's extremely ingrained in our national culture at all levels. So sometimes it's easy to forget that it really happened and it wasn't really that long ago. And I'm sure that at some point during this, one, two, or all three of us, maybe even right after I finish talking, Matthew's going to say something absolutely disgusting, but one of us is going to say something flippant about this in ways we haven't been about other murders on the show, so let me apologize for that in advance. Also, please remember that until the very end, I'm going to be reporting on what other people think happened that day. If you don't like what you hear, don't shoot the messenger, at least until the end when I tell you what I think. And finally, even though I promise I'm going to try and do this to the best of my ability, I am not an expert. I'm just an internet comedian. I'm probably going to make some mistakes, maybe even some egregious ones. So again, let me apologize for that in advance and for whatever disgusting thing Mathis is about to say. And now,
listen,
without further ado,
I just had a scientific curiosity. Do you think when his brains were blown out, the part of his brain still in the skull, if you pushed it, it gave him like a boner on command? You'd be like,
you see?
And it's like, what? Pop
why
up. And
then he's kind of say that. Boop,
boop, boop, like a little boner button in his brain that was still hanging out.
I got a boner button in my brain, baby.
Oh, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Just imagine maybe one of like the Secret Service agents in the hospital when nobody was around.
No one did that.
You know what my boner button's called? Pregnant Pokemon drawings. That's what it's called. Just kidding.
What is this podcast?
It's just, you know, it is what it is.
Listen, this is marked explicit every episode.
Please make sure you can see my fiance in the background of the webcam.
No one can see
her. Holding her head in her hands and crying.
All I see is she's disappointed very hard. Right, and laughing.
It checks out.
Weeping for her loss.
It's because they share that together.
Which pregnant Clefairy. Pokemon is the hottest?
Clefairy is the one.
Gardevoir.
That's yours?
Pregnant no, that's Clefairy. The one that she left the room. She literally got up and left the room. Ladies and gentlemen, the fiance has left the building.
It's over.
Give me a pregnant Trubbish and I will rail
pregnant
that
Trubbish,
thing.
That's what you want? You heard it, folks. Send that to my boy Mathis.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Last time,
pregnant
we
Snorlax.
Ended, yeah, pregnant Snorlax. He already is. That's the thing. They just didn't know. It was like one of those Montel episodes.
Yeah.
8 months pregnant. I didn't know. Last time we ended with a section called the cleanup, and now it's 29 through 32, which is called cleanup again. So first today, before we start with new information, I just want to have Mathis read just the last part of the Justice Department memo I read a couple weeks ago in the mini-sode I did as a little trailer for this first little JFK starter pack trilogy that I made here.
Yeah, if you want the JFK prequel, you know, the preamble, go to patreon.com/IlluminatiPod.
Yeah, and this it's from 3 days after President Kennedy was assassinated. It's Monday, November 25th, 1963. I dropped it in Twitter for you, Mathis. Give it a little.
I got you. Yep. Here it is. The matter has been handled thus far with neither dignity nor conviction. Facts have been mixed with rumor and speculation. We can scarcely let the world see us totally in the image of the Dallas police than when our president is murdered. Wait, did I say that right? We can scarcely let the world see us totally in the image of the Dallas police when our president is murdered. I think this objective may be satisfied by making public as soon as possible a complete and thorough FBI report on Oswald and the assassination. This may run into the difficulty of pointing to inconsistencies between this report and the statements by Dallas police officials, but the reputation of the Bureau is such that it may do the whole job. The only other step would be the appointment of a presidential commission of unimpeachable personnel to review and examine the evidence. Oop. Your new message bumped it all down.
Sorry. Yeah.
The only other step would be the appointment of a presidential commission of unimpeachable personnel to review and examine the evidence and announce its conclusions. This has both advantages and disadvantages. I think it can await publication of the FBI report and public reaction to it here and abroad. I think, however, that a statement that all the facts will be made public property in an orderly and responsible way should be made now. We need something to head off public speculation or congressional hearings of the wrong sort. Nicholas Katzenbach, Deputy Attorney General.
Yeah. Now, just like I said last time, I love this memo because depending on what you believe, this memo either means one, that this it's like an expression of shame after a fucked up media circus and just a desire from the government to get the real accurate story out there for people to read, which is like, you know, one sensible reading of this. And the other one, too, as Jesse Ventura puts it, the smoking gun in a plot to cover up certain details of the conspiracy that was carried out on that fateful day. So regardless of which one you believe, the memo is kind of interesting and is sort of just like this sort of proof that the government was thinking about this, you know. But Jesse Ventura says, and this is all actually with his own emphasis, which he conveyed with both italics and sometimes an underline, quote, "And that's why they formed the Warren Commission. That's the real reason, not to find the truth, but to bury it." That's what he said.
Dun, dun, dun.
I'm not sure which one you guys are leaning towards at this point, but up next, I have a couple different pieces of evidence to the book says to look at here, which are definitely closer to the option two side of the fence, if you know what I mean. First thing on the list is the fact that after President Kennedy was shot on the Friday, the limousine he was sitting in when everything went down, probably an endless supply of good forensic evidence, was already back in Detroit at the Ford factory, getting stripped down and rebuilt shiny and new. According to Ford Motor Company senior manager George Whitaker Sr., who worked at the Rouge plant in Detroit, he found the car the same morning that the Justice Department memo was sent out, Monday, the 25th, with fully gutted The car was fully gutted in the process of having its windshield replaced. He also saw the original windshield behind a locked door in the glass plant lab and explained that everything in the car had been completely destroyed and replaced. Also, according to somewhat controversial Louisiana DA Jim Garrison, the president's corpse and his limousine were handled in a surprisingly similar manner. Here's a quote for Jesse to read, which I would appreciate him doing in a sugary sweet tone, like the one taken on by Kevin Costner when he played this man in Oliver Stone's much disputed but still worth watching from a skeptical perspective, largely fictional film JFK.
Sugary sweet. The government succeeded in accomplishing what normally it would not be able to accomplish in another city. Succeeded in getting the body of the president out of Dallas without an autopsy. In other words, Air Force One didn't so much take off as it made a getaway. The plane took off with the body of the president. We can't say it made a getaway and then say the plane to anyway. The plane took off with the body of the president. And no civilian autopsy had been conducted. Then the body was placed in a controlled environment the military hospital at Bethesda, and there the autopsy was conducted. After the autopsy, Commander Humes, who conducted the autopsy, burned his notes, which is probably the first time in history that a serious autopsy resulted in the burning of notes.
Every time, I just need Jesse's voice to be masked and muddled while he speaks.
I love that, right?
Yeah.
I have no way of knowing whether it was the first time in history that somebody burned their notes or not. That seems insane. But it was actually true that according to Texas law, jurisdiction for the autopsy fell very clearly to local authorities rather than the federal ones. Like, that's the whole thing with Texas, right?
Sure.
They want their own authority over the government's authority. So it makes sense that that was their law. But also, here's another quote for Mathis to read from a Secret Service expert I've mentioned before, a guy called Vince Palomara, who said the battle for the president's body was waged between Secret Service agents and Dallas police at gunpoint.
Oh, God. All right. Ironically, two of the agents who participated in that illegal seizure of the president's body at gunpoint were Roy Kellerman and Bill Greer, who rode in JFK's limousine and were paramount to his supposed security. Since the murder of a president was not then a federal crime, the agents had zero jurisdiction.
Yeah. And literally,
that true?
100%.
Even in the 60s, multiple presidents have been shot and they still were like, not a federal crime.
This is why the law changed. Was
crazy.
So, you know, this is a nut thing. And this is like a very nuts thing for them to do because the law actually changed as a result of this happening. But it doesn't stop with the Secret Service, as there's also fairly decent grounds to half suppose that the FBI might have been involved in covering things up as well, starting with the fact that literally 24 hours after the president was shot, without any real evidence at all, the FBI's actual real biological daddy, J. Edgar Hoover, had already declared with certainty that Oswald was the killer. Admittedly, this seems weak on its own as evidence, but apparently there was also quite a bit of possible evidence and witness tampering going on all the time, too, often in the context of strong-arming these witnesses into actually revising their version of events. We talked about this already a little bit last time with the guy who got shot in the head and maybe changed his story after seeing another guy hiding with Oswald in the car parking lot or whatever. But other witnesses even said that they went to go read their own testimonies back after the fact and were, like, horrified that basically what they told the agents interviewing them was just, like, straight up changed, and we'll touch on that a little bit later too. And this was because, according to Senator Richard Swiker, they were trying to obscure and clear their connection to both Oswald, aka informant number 179, and Jack Ruby. And here is a quote from that senator for Jesse to read right now. I'm going to drop that in the little Zoom box for you.
Jesse, your voice has to be like this. You got to be like,
I can't be like that. I'm a senator.
Yeah.
Now, why did the FBI withhold for 12 years that Ruby had informed for them on 9 occasions? That's the wrong. That's probably shouldn't do that
Everybody from now on, we all do JFK voices, okay?
Seems insensitive, considering the context.
True.
This wasn't national security information, so why were they so sensitive? Also, I'm certain there were extenuating circumstances in his activities running guns to Cuba. We were really running a secret war against Cuba, and we know the CIA was heavily involved. Ruby had to have been at least working for someone who was working for the CIA.
Yep, and that's a senator again. And then we have the quote from J. Edgar Hoover's phone call, where he's briefing President Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy's vice president, about Oswald the day after the assassination, where he says, quote, "We have up here the tape and the photograph of the man who was at the Soviet embassy. That picture and the tape do not correspond to this man's voice, nor to his appearance. It appears that there is a second person who was at the Soviet embassy." Like, why would that even be on the table as a conversation that anyone would be having if Oswald wasn't into some type of secret agent type shit? You know what I mean? Like, why would that even be a topic of conversation? You know what I mean? And here's a quote from Mathis to read from a former aide to U.S. House Majority Leader Hale Boggs, from the time he served on the Warren Commission. Here we go. This is for Mathis.
Is it going to be Zoom or Twitter?
Zoom.
Here it is. Hale always returned to one thing. Hoover lied his eyes out to the commission on Oswald, on Ruby, on their friends, the bullets, the gun, you name it.
Yeah. So, like, everybody knew that he was lying or making it up, or it was coming from a manipulative place. And the next summer, when Hoover was chilling out at the Hotel Del Charro down near San Diego with a bunch of super right wing Texas oil barons that he liked to vibe out with. One guy, Billy Byers Jr., who was like a teenage son of the like Baron Billy Byers, asked Hoover if he thought Oswald shot Kennedy, and Hoover had this to say, quote, "If I told you what I really know, it would be very dangerous to this country. Our whole political system could be disrupted." Anyway,
so why even say that?
Yeah, I know. Make that what you will. Let me know if you can see through it.
Also,
though,
oil barons reminds me, there's a lady a couple blocks over, bumper sticker says spoiled oil wife.
Oh, yeah.
Just kind of popped into my head.
You live next to a giant mansion. Is that right?
I mean, it's bigger than what I live in.
You are in Texas.
It's not,
so, I mean, that checks out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough.
So
that's all.
Do you think that you can see through my allegations, or does it remind you of my next section, number 33 through 35, the X-rays? Get it? You see what I did there? This next section is about X-rays, and which you let you see through stuff. Like the title says.
Oh, I see. Okay, there it is. They connected.
Sorry.
Researcher and former OSS agent and State Department intelligence analyst Harold Weisberg first brought forth the serious possibility that the X-rays of the president's head showed all kinds of bullet pieces and particles like scattered all through his skull. Corroborating that is the congressional testimony from one of the morticians who saw the president's corpse that day, a guy called Thomas Robinson, who said, quote, "It exited in many pieces," and quote, "they were literally picked out little pieces of this bullet from all over his head." This is kind of maybe what you might expect from a bullet wound to the head, I suppose. Maybe. But if you remember from part one, we were talking about frangible and non-frangible ammo, which makes this pretty compelling evidence for an alternative to the official story. Basically, the Carcano rifle Oswald is holding in those pictures, and which he officially used to assassinate the president, is a military weapon, which, as per the Geneva Convention and NATO, we know is forbidden from firing fragmenting or frangible bullets. So that's how we know for sure.
Yeah. But hold on. If you're going to shoot the president, forbidden is like, at that point, it doesn't matter.
No, I just mean the gun can't shoot them. It doesn't shoot them. It's not built to shoot them. Cannot shoot them. So that's how we know for sure that that rifle, as a result of that, shoots full metal jacket bullets. That's the only kind that fit in it, which definitely don't fragment, even though it seems like maybe the bullet in the president's head did fragment, which is, you know, not consistent. And next, to go along with this general strangeness, I have a few quotes taken straight from the book for Jesse to read, and then some for Mathis to read, just so we're all on the same page about what people saw that day at the hospital while these X-rays and autopsy photos were being taken. And this is definitely going to be a Twitter boy for Jesse here.
Okay, so there are multiple people here. Secret Service agent or special agent Clint Hill. The right rear portion of his head was missing. It was lying in the rear seat of the car. His brain was exposed. There was blood and bits of brain all over the entire rear portion of the car. Mrs. Kennedy was completely covered in blood. There was so much blood you could not tell if there had been any other wound or not, except for the one large gaping wound in the right rear portion of the head. This is Nurse Diana Bowron.
There was a gaping wound in the back of his head. It was gone. There was nothing there, just a big gaping hole. There might have been little clumps of scalp, but most of the bone over the hole, there was no bone there. There was no damage to the front of his face. Only wound in the back of his head and the entry wound in his throat. The wound was so large I could almost put my whole fist into it.
Nurse Doris Nelson.
There wasn't even hair back there. It was blown away. All that area was blown out.
Nurse Pat Hutton.
A doctor asked me to place pressure.
Oh, you got so many voices.
You're working for them all.
This was no use, however, because of the massive opening on the back of his head.
Dr. Malcolm Perry.
There was blood note on the carriage. Oh, blood noted. Oops, sorry. There was blood noted on the carriage and a large avulsive wound on the right posterior cranium.
This man said posterior cranium?
He
Hold
did.
On, let me redo that.
Well, I see there was blood noted on the carriage and a large elusive wound on the right posterior cranium.
Better. I think that was better.
That was great.
The next couple are for Mathis. I apologize again. Excellent. For the colorful imagery, I suppose you could call it.
Apologizing to the wrong people. All right. Twitter again. Yep. Here it is. Okay. Dr. Ronald Jones. There was a large defect in the backside of the head as the president lay on the cot with what appeared to be some brain hanging out of his wound, with multiple pieces of skull noted next with the brain and the tremendous amount of clot and blood. There's a large, I wouldn't know if I would call the giant gunshot a large defect on his skull, but hey, I mean, everybody uses their own, I guess, descriptors.
Yeah.
Paul Peters. I noticed the head wound, and as I remember, I noticed there was a large defect in the occiput. I don't know. How do you say that?
I'm not sure. 100%. Occiput.
For everybody out there, O-C-C-I-P-U-T.
Like ocular, maybe? Like occiput?
That's what I was thinking. Like occiput.
Occiput? What is the 2C?
Yeah, I don't know. It's very confusing.
It's got to be oc or os.
Yeah. I'm going to go with occiput. It seemed to me that in the right occipital parietal area, that there was a large defect. There appeared to be bone loss and brain loss in the area. We speculated as to whether he had been shot once or twice because we saw the wound of entry in the throat and noted the large occipital wound.
Occipital. I hate that word.
Occipital word.
So
yeah,
apparently it's occipit. Occiput. Get out of town.
Occiput.
Occiput. All right. You know, we all learn. Dr. Kemp Clark then said, I then examined the wound in the back of the president's head. There was a large gaping wound in the right posterior part with cerebral and cerebellar tissue being damaged and exposed. Then Nurse Margaret Hinchcliffe, I've only got one lady voice.
The president has a gaping wound in the back of his head and an entrance wound in his throat.
That sounds like a little tiny man is what it sounds like. He's real.
Yeah. You got to like, remember, it isn't about the high pitch, it's about the inclination. Just imagine you're a lady. Don't worry about the high pitch. You don't need that.
Maybe
not
she's
all women have high pitched voices.
Maybe she's an aggressive New York woman with an extremely high pitched voice.
Maybe
okay?
She's a little mouse who lives on a boat.
Bethesda photographer Floyd Ribe. A big gaping hole in the back of the head. That's very simple.
Yep.
FBI special agent Frank O'Neill. We'll give him the mixed voice.
A massive wound in the right rear.
Yeah.
There you go.
But yeah, all this just to say that it wasn't just a couple people misremembering this. And honestly, anyone who saw President John F. Kennedy with his skull blown out is probably going to remember it for the rest of their life anyway. There's even similar accounts of people remembering a big entry wound on the front of President Kennedy's forehead near his hairline, too. But that is actually somewhat reflected in the actual autopsy photos, which I'll give you a link to right now. But if you guys are actually Googling these photos, which you absolutely should not do, unless you're ready to see some very disturbing stuff, you'll notice that the pictures themselves.
You're sending it to us? I got to look at this?
You don't have to if you don't want to.
Oh, man. Whoa. No, that's unpleasant.
Yeah. You'll notice that the pictures themselves and everything else these people said don't really match with each other. Like, you don't see. There's actually a picture of the back of his head, which is not a gaping hole in this photograph. So why is that? So according to David W. Mantic, who's both a physician and a JFK assassination researcher who's legit enough to be cited by the museum that currently occupies the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository Building, which is like a really good museum. That's because some modifications were made. And here is a quote about that for Jesse to read. I'm going to try and put it in the Zoom. Nope, it's going in Twitter. It's just got to go in the Twitter.
Instead, they, the official autopsy photos and x-rays, were taken after tampering by H&B, Dr. Humes and Dr. Boswell, the two physicians who performed the autopsy of President Kennedy. Perhaps even after significant tampering, especially if Robinson and Reed are correct. Furthermore, the massive damage seen in the photographs and x-rays was not caused just by a bullet, or even by multiple bullets, but instead by pathological hands. In particular, for a single full metal jacketed bullet, the Warren Commission's inevitable scenario, to generate such an enormous defect, has always defied credibility. Likewise, Boswell's sketch for the Assassination Records Review Board on the skull of this enormous defect only shows the condition of the skull after tampering by H and B, and does not reflect the skull as seen at Parkland Hospital in Dallas. The Parkland witnesses fully concur with this. On the other hand, many witnesses at Bethesda saw the condition of the skull before such tampering began. These witnesses, both physicians and paraprofessionals, whatever that is, uniformly describe a right occipital blowout, right rear of skull, consistent with a shot from the front.
And if you want to get even more detailed about what exactly went down in that regard, here's another quote from the mortician that day, Tom Robinson, who said they'd actually filled in that original wound with something, quote, about the size of a small orange, circular, ragged, directly behind the back of his head. They brought a piece of heavy-duty rubber, again, to fill this area in the back of the head. It had to be all dried out, packed, and the rubber placed in the hair, and the skin pulled back over and stitched into that piece of rubber. It's pretty morose and bizarre for the mortician who worked on his body that day to say that, which I also think makes this pretty tough to stomach. Because why, if you saw something like this, wouldn't you immediately blow it up in every newspaper, right?
Yeah.
Well, counter to that, maybe it's because of what happened to Navy Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer. Pitzer was the, quote, head of the Navy TV unit at the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maine, meaning he was in charge of the audiovisual department, meaning that at the time of Kennedy's assassination, he certainly handled all of the film and stuff associated with the autopsy. Some people have even said he was present for the actual autopsy itself, but according to what I could see, this was not able to be substantiated. Officially, though, years later, on October 29th, 1966, Pitzer was found dead in his office at the Medical Center TV studio, days away from Navy retirement and with an excellent new job lined up teaching AV at a college from what was said to be a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. However, a couple things seem strange. Firstly, the dude was, quote, very cheerful, end quote, that day, and most people wouldn't have said he was depressed. He also did chores, he cooked breakfast, he grabbed some groceries for later, and checked in on some work stuff that day, which seems like it would be a strange thing to do if you were planning on being gone from this world in a few hours. He also actually wrote himself a note reminding himself to return the revolver to the security office after he was done with it, which you wouldn't do if you were about to blow your own brains out. And furthermore, GSR tests established that the victim had not recently fired a weapon and that the revolver used to shoot him was held over 3 feet away from his head when it was fired, which was made even more bizarre by the fact that these results were kept from the family by the FBI for years. And also, there's Daniel Marvin. Daniel Marvin was a Green Beret who commanded a team in South Vietnam from December 1965 to August 1966 and was the leader of a 12-man special forces team sent into Cambodia after the Viet Cong, who eventually retired as a lieutenant colonel in 1973. Here's an excerpt from a thing he wrote in 1995, which I'll read for you now, and which basically corroborates and colors in this whole story. Here we go. In the fall of 1993, while I was watching a documentary on the JFK assassination, I was stunned to see the name of William Pitzer flash across the screen in a list of violent deaths putatively linked with the cover-up of a conspiracy. Seeing that name jolted my memory back to the first week of August 1965 at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Colonel Clarence W. Patton, commanding officer of my unit, the 6th Special Forces Group, summoned me with instructions to meet a company man in an area adjacent to headquarters. Another Green Beret captain named David H. Vanek, with whom I had taken assassination training, joined me outside the building and we walked together, asking each other what this was all about. Neither of us had an inkling, except that it must be a covert mission of some sort. Not far, perhaps 100 yards, and in the shade of some nearby pine trees, a slender man of 5'10" waited. Dressed casually in short sleeves, light slacks, and sunglasses appropriate for the August heat, he flashed his ID and took me aside. Would I terminate a man who was preparing to give state secrets to the enemy, a traitor in the making? I asked who the traitor was, and I was told he was a Navy officer, a Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer. The agent told me that Pitzer worked at Bethesda Naval Hospital. He said nothing of a link with the JFK autopsy, and I just assumed that Pitzer was one of those sorry types that went wrong and was going to sell secrets to our enemy. The job had to be done at Bethesda before the man retired from the Navy. I really didn't care about killing Pitzer, but I wasn't about to do that sort of thing here in the USA.
And from the beginning, it was understood that we would be used overseas, not in our home turf. So I refused the mission after he'd already told me the guy's name, which is not a good thing. The agent seemed irritated, sure enough, but he'd goofed and he knew I was one of theirs. And when we parted, he and I both knew that the name would be as good as forgotten by me. I sure wouldn't want to compromise the plot to rid our military of a traitor, would I? The agent then simply turned around and walked over to meet Captain Vanek, who was just waiting out of earshot, and I headed back to my office. Whether or not that agent offered Vanek the same mission or whether or not he accepted the mission is only for him to say. I have neither seen nor heard of him these past 29 years. My numerous attempts to locate Vanek through the Department of the Army's Veterans Services Directorate in St. Louis were met with a 15th December 1994 response that their office had, quote, been unable to identify a record of service for the person concerned, end quote. Not true. On 23rd December 1994, I asked in writing for Senators Kennedy, D'Amato, and Moynihan to investigate this possible cover-up action. To date, there has been no substantive reply from any of the senators, and it appears that when there is an alleged illegal CIA involvement, even angels fear to tread. So what do you think of that?
Pretty well. You got cut out there for a second for me. What did you say?
What did you think? What do you think of that concept?
I'm always wary when someone says I met with someone, they're a top secret agent, they asked me to do a thing, they told me a bunch of information. I was like, nah, not me. And then I like got away with it. There's only two options here. Either one, it's a total lie because they would never be like, hey, I'm going to let you know who you should kill. No one does that. Or two, dude killed that person and is like, oh, but it wasn't me.
It could be.
It kind of reminds me of someone else. Bringing us way back to like the mid 20s, we did Missing 411 for a couple episodes, and the main guy behind that, who was once a cop, but he was like a beat cop for a while. He what got him into that is he met with a park or like a government ranger or whatever that on the condition of remaining anonymous told him all the truth of all these people who keep going missing, and the government pretends it doesn't happen, even though.
Right.
You know, like that kind of thing. It kind of reminds me of that. It's like, well, now I have to take you at your word. I don't have a choice. It's either I believe you,
right,
or everything you just told me falls apart.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And it's funny that you say missing 411 because the next section, 36 and 37, is called Missing Pieces.
Yeah. It's like a poem. It rhymes.
You want to know what the original joke was there, for the segue? Did I leave anything out? Anyway, time for 36 and 37, Missing Pieces. Just so you guys...
It's still pretty good, though, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad we went with what we did.
Yeah, that's okay. Now that we're through the autopsy photos, let's take a look at some weirdness having to do with two of the other pillars of the JFK assassination iceberg, the Zapruder film and the Magic Bullet. We're going to give another look at those. Firstly, here is a quote from Douglas Horn, who is a chief analyst for military records for the Assassinations Records Review Board, and that's going to be for Mathis to read, and that's going to go in Twitter.
Okay. There it is. Here we go. The Review Board held a public hearing, which was televised by C-SPAN. One of the people watching happened to be one of two people who actually magnified individual frames from the Zapruder film the weekend of the assassination and made prints for three briefing boards for use in briefing high officials in the government. The individual who watched the Z film... the individual who watched the Z film hearing on C-SPAN was named Morgan Bennett Hunter, and his supervisor in 1963 was Homer McMahon. Both were then CIA employees at NPIC, the National Photo Interpretation Center. The story that Homer and his assistant Ben told us was that on the weekend of the assassination, they had a film brought to them by the Secret Service. The Z film was brought to them at NPIC on either Saturday night or Sunday night after the assassination because they were positive it was before the president's funeral, which was on Monday. They said that the agent brought what he represented to them as being the original Zapruder film. He did not come from Dallas. He came from Rochester, New York, where he said the film had been developed, and he used a code word for a classified film laboratory that the CIA had paid Kodak to set up and run in Rochester, their headquarters and main industrial facility.
Yeah. But in contrast to that, we already know, thanks to processing affidavits used to establish chain of custody for the film, that it was absolutely developed for sure in Dallas on November 22nd, the day of the assassination, before it went anywhere else. So if it was already developed, what was it doing in a photo lab in Rochester, New York? Well, I have a possible reason for that for Jesse to read from the same guy, Douglas Horn. And I'm going to drop that right into the Zoom chat.
If the authentic original film was really shot in slow motion and you wanted to remove certain events, such as the car stop on Elm Street that over 50 Dealey Plaza eyewitnesses testified to, you would need to remove several frames and then recreate a film that runs at normal speed. And that is much shorter than the original in terms of total number of frames. Furthermore, if you wanted to eliminate evidence of shots from the front, you would need to black out the exit wound in the back of the head and in some frames, and even more, even remove some frames showing exit debris in midair. The image alteration in these frames would be done using the technique called aerial imaging at a facility that possessed a sophisticated optical printer.
Which is exactly what the CIA Kodak Photo Lab in Rochester would have. And so during
Kodak
the break,
is responsible for this?
They made the lab. Yeah, they helped. Right,
so
the
Kodak
CIA make
isn't
the
on it.
Oh yeah, there it just goes all the way up to the top to Kodak
at the very top. Jesse, there's no such thing as a conspiracy where thousands of people aren't just keeping a secret. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering. I mean, just putting this out there. Kodak still exists as a company. Yet, how many people you know buying film?
It's the Radio Shack of cameras. Think about it.
I'm curious. Hang on. So what this is saying is that
these guys
shot in slow motion to hide frames.
Yeah, basically, like, no, the camera was the footage was shot in slow motion, which is more frames per second. Right. Like,
right.
If you shoot something that's supposed to run at 24 frames per second at 120 frames per second, if you play it back, it's going to go slower. Right. So what they're saying
is,
to edit it, you're removing the frames in between the frames and bringing those frames closer together for a normal speed clip that's going to run a lot shorter.
So they're saying there was some editing done.
They're saying, like, yeah, they'd go in and take out some of the clips in slow motion or black out some of the clips and move them together to make it look like
my,
it's
my other question was, and maybe I'm wrong, the kind of camera that was used, is it hand crank or is it at this time was it normal, like did it run on
that
its own?
I am not 100% sure of,
because if it's hand crank you're immediately human error is going to be run rampant. Something surprising happens, the crank slows down, they stop, they pick it back up.
The hand crank that's actually a hand crank is actually probably a little bit before this, and what you'd have is something on a spring. So you wind it first and then it goes like this. You see the little handle go around.
You know more than I do in terms of like that kind of camera back then.
I have a camera like that that does that.
Oh, cool.
That's like one of these weird handheld ones. It's like Super 8 something. It's like not quite Super 8, something else, but you know, those old home movie cameras, that's how they operated. But yeah, so basically this happened. They said, hey, we got the original Zapruder film. It's here from Rochester, which is wild because you'd think, oh, it was developed there and brought back, but it wasn't. It was definitely developed in Texas. So why was it there? Why was it coming back? Why did it happen during a break in the chain of custody? And why did it come back to Dallas even before the funeral so quickly? You know, like there's just a lot of questions about that. It's just like a weird thing. That's all it is. That's what this whole
episode is. We definitely have evidence that it did move to New York and go back, right? We have evidence other than somebody saying it.
That's like what it is. It's the Secret Service agents brought them this on the weekend of the assassination. It was brought to them at the MPIC. I don't know if that's like an official record, but I don't think these people have any reason to lie about that. These are just the people that worked there. But yeah. Now let's talk about the magic bullet. It has been a few weeks, but if you remember, we know that according to the official story, we have one dude shooting bullets. That's Oswald. We have three bullets that he shot. And we know that one of those bullets skipped off the curb and cut that dude James's face with shrapnel. We know about that one already. Then we know that there's the bullet hole in Kennedy's jacket. And then we know that there's a bullet hole in Kennedy's head. So that's canonically one miss, two hits. Obviously, the third shot was the explosive kill shot that we can see in the Zapruder film. So we know where that bullet went. And that basically just leaves that one middle bullet to do literally everything else. According to Arlen Specter from the Warren Commission, that means that middle bullet penetrated the president, then almost turned to enter Governor Connally, then went through him, then went back into him again, and then stopped inside of him. If you want to see a classic version of this, which is both seriously acted and parodied by Wayne Knight in Seinfeld and Oliver Stone's JFK, a movie you should watch but shouldn't fully trust, here's a link to the clip of the movie right here if you guys want to like throw that on in the background. But I'm sure you guys have seen it. Yeah,
I'll throw that up there right now. Let's take a look.
That's
solemn music is playing.
Yeah, that's seven wounds, two people, one bullet. Right? That's a pretty crazy thing. It's like a 2-minute clip, so I'm just going to keep talking, but you can kind of suss it as you watch. Also,
wait, hang on.
You sent us a link to the Dark Side of Hollywood, Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
What?
We're currently watching the Dark Side of Hollywood.
This is the second time this has happened. Are you all right?
Wait, what happened?
You sent the video us a link you linked us
to a Vanity Fair video. Dark Side of Hollywood icon, Jerry Lewis.
What are these fucking links that I'm getting? Like, I watched this video. I watched this clip.
I mean, sure. I'm sure you did.
The Dark Side of Jerry Lewis? Mm-hmm.
Yes. An 8-minute Vanity Fair video.
Let's just put it this way. You guys know that there's a movie called JFK with this scene in it with Kevin Costner with the magic bullet. Oh. It's parodied in Seinfeld. We have established this. You don't need to watch it.
Taking care of business. You can check it out.
BTO, taking care of business. No big deal. yeah. Seven wounds, two people, one bullet. And also, apparently, this is the same bullet that shows up mysteriously in pristine condition and free of any bloodstains on a stretcher in Parkland Hospital out of nowhere. And how can that even be possible if Governor Connally died an old man later, years later, decades later from that bullet? He has lead from that bullet still in his arm skeleton in his gravestone. How could the bullet itself still be pristine? I have a link to Warren Commission Exhibit 399, which shows both this bullet and a diagram of Arlen Specter's version of the bullet trajectory. You can try and explain that to the people if you want, but you can really talk to that bullet is untouched. That bullet is very clean for something that went through two people and caused seven injuries. And
what we're looking at is the bullet, obviously, which does look in pristine condition. The back of it is bent, I think, or something.
Yeah, it's a little
I don't
mushed.
Know what that bottom picture is.
It's a little mush, yeah, but it's definitely not fragmented.
There's the diagram showing the bullet would have entered kind of like between his shoulder blades, in through his throat, out his shoulder, and then rotated and into, I assume that's Governor Connally, right?
Like, yeah, that, it's actually an amazing sketch of Governor Connally, too. I want to just give credit to the artist here. That looks a lot like Governor Connally.
But it's,
yeah, and it would have entered his arm and out his wrist.
It is important to note the shift of the bullet. Like, it is straight on
spins.
When it hits Kennedy, it exits Kennedy and then spins. And then the spin, basically the butt end of the bullet is what hits
it, like,
the governor.
Rotates and through then his body, I guess. I don't
goes
know.
Goes through his body, then out his hand, his arm, then back through his arm, then back out the other side of his arm. While still maintaining like a spin. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you want some sense of how some high profile people were feeling about this feeling at the time. What? That's not what I meant to say. Feeling about this at the time. Here's a short little phone call clip from Mathis and Jesse to read. Mathis is going to be Senator Richard Russell, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and actual member of the Warren Commission. And Jesse is going to be President Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Oh, boy. Yes.
They was trying to prove that the same bullet that hit Kennedy first was the one that hit Connally and went through him and went through his hand and his bone and into his leg and everything else. But they said that the commission believed that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. Well, I don't believe it.
I don't either.
Yeah. So neither Johnson nor the senator, believed this, and this dude is on the Warren Commission, you know what I mean? But anyway, that bullet thing, pretty wild. Like I say, I'm gonna do a pro lone gunman theory episode later, so I know there's people who are angry about the gun stuff. I know there are alternative explanations about these guns.
You gotta open up your mind, people. Open up that,
it's
that
not
brain
even that.
And allow the part of your brain that's like, hey, logic, turn it off, okay? And then just sit back and absorb it like I'm talking to you about aliens.
Yeah,
and
like
just
become stupid for a minute.
Yeah, you just have to be stupid for a little bit.
I'm just trying to educate you about what people are saying. Like, I want you guys to understand this conspiracy theory from the, it's a big one.
He's a big boy.
It's a big old boy. But yeah, like I say, I'm going to do a pro lone gunman theory episode later, but there is certainly enough going on here to give someone pause. And
certainly.
Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit more about Louisiana DA Jim Garrison in 38 and 39, Jim Garrison. Yeah. First,
Jim Gaffigan.
Jim Gaffigan. Let's talk a little bit about Jim Gaffigan. No, let's first do a brief summary of Harrison's involvement with the case. I mean, sorry, Garrison's involvement with the case, not George Harrison, which has been so hard not to say. Jim Garrison, not George Harrison. Basically,
very different.
Basically, like I said, he was the DA of New Orleans in 1966, and he started to look into the JFK assassination because on the day it went down, an FBI agent in New Orleans called Guy Bannister pistol whipped a private detective called Jack Martin over missing files or a phone bill or something like that. And Martin was so pissed off that to get back at him, he ratted Bannister out, saying that he'd seen him with this dude, David Ferry, who he thinks might have been connected to the assassination.
All these are family names for me, and this is very weird. Yeah.
He said Ferry knew Oswald from when they were serving in the New Orleans Civil Air Patrol, and that he drove to Dallas from New Orleans the night of November 21st, and that he, quote, was supposed to have been the getaway pilot in the assassination, end quote. This led all the way up the ladder to a businessman in town called Clay Shaw being arrested and taken to trial 3 years later. And during the trial, Garrison was actually the guy who originally subpoenaed the Zapruder film from the Life magazine, who owned it. And then and this was the way that people ended up being able to see the Zapruder film for the first time. His aides were like bootlegging the film as they were working with it, which is kind of cool. And then I think like in like 10 years ago or something, Garrison's daughter actually like gave out his personal copy of it too, which is kind of cool. But yeah, that's one of the big things about this Garrison case is that it got us the Zapruder film. But anyway, in the years leading up to the trial, Garrison kicked off a huge investigation that uncovered tons of crazy witnesses and evidence of FBI and CIA intervention and mafia connections. But without getting too far into the weeds, we'll jump deep into that in a later episode. Let's just focus on Oswald, Clay Shaw, and the idea that the official story was altered on purpose to cover up key details as we move forward. Firstly, there's Dean Andrews. Dean Andrews was a smooth-talking Southern attorney who knowingly concealed that this guy, Clem Bertrand, was actually Clay Shaw. You know, people were talking about this guy, Clem Bertrand. They're actually talking about Clay Shaw. Garrison was using him in this case to establish that link between Lee Harvey Oswald and Clay Shaw, which I'll talk about in a second. But here is a little conversation from Garrison's book for you guys to read, which shows that he was likely intimidated into changing his story. Jesse is going to reprise his role as Jim Garrison, and Mathis is going to be Dean Andrews, the smooth-talking country lawyer.
Oh, God. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. That's a challenging role for someone like me. He's not professionally trained. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Wait, where do we start? Okay, there it is.
You start. Yeah. If you lied to the grand jury, as you have been lying to me, I'm going to charge you with perjury. Now, am I communicating with you?
Is this off the record, Daddy-O?
I'm nodding.
He nods, everybody. Yeah. Well, in that case, let me sum it up for real quick. It's as simple as this. If I answer that question, you keep asking me. If I give you the name you keep trying to get, then it's a goodbye, Dean Andrews. It's bon voyage, Dino. I mean, like permanent. I mean, like a bullet in my head, which makes it hard to do one's legal research if you get my drift. Does that help you see my problem a little better?
Never read my lips. I can't tell if there's some chemistry between us, but are we going to have sex right now? That's how I feel.
This is like Gambit from X-Men talking to a clone of himself.
I thought I was the smooth-talking Southern man for this.
Both of you guys are. You're the same smooth-talking man.
Read my lips. Either you dance in to the grand jury with the real moniker of that cat you called, who called you to represent Lee Oswald, or your fat behind is going to the slammer. You dig me?
I stand up suddenly. Do you have any idea what you're getting into, my man? You want to dance with the government? Is that what you want? Then be my guest. but you will get sat on, and I do mean hard.
Oh my God, are we about to have sex right now?
I did rent an Airbnb down the street.
Screw the Airbnb. I'm taking doing care of business right here in this room.
Every
right
day. Now.
Middle of the street.
Working overtime. Workout. Oh, yeah.
All right. What a conversation. Taking if that was business. A real conversation.
Right?
Like,
yeah.
What a weird conversation.
It's fucking nuts. Another interesting thing that Garrison uncovered was the possibly doctored testimony of witness Julia Ann Mercer, who I'll read about for you from Garrison's own interactions with her personally. About an hour before the assassination, she had been driving west on Elm Street and had been stopped just past the grassy knoll by traffic congestion. To her surprise, because she recalled that the president's parade is coming soon, she saw a young man in the pickup truck to her right dismount, carrying a rifle, not too well concealed, in a covering of some sort. She then observed him walk up the grassy hill, which forms part of the overpass. She looked at the driver several times, got a good look at his round face and brown eyes, and he looked right back at her. Mercer also observed that three police officers were standing near a motorcycle on the overpass bridge above her and just ahead. She recalled that they showed no curiosity about the young man climbing the side of the grassy knoll with the rifle. After the assassination, when Mercer sought to make this information available to law enforcement authorities, their response was almost frenzied. At the FBI office where she went that day after the assassination, she was shown a number of mugshots. Among the several she selected as resembling the driver was a photograph of Jack Ruby. On Sunday, when she saw Ruby kill Oswald on television, she positively recognized him as the driver of the pickup truck and promptly notified the local bureau office. Nevertheless, the FBI altered her statement so it did not note that she had made a positive identification. She laughed when she pointed this out to me. See, she said, the FBI made it just the opposite of what I really told them. Then she added, he was only a few feet away from me. How could I not recognize Jack Ruby when I saw him shoot Oswald on television? The Dallas Sheriff's Office went through the same laborious fraud and added an imaginative touch of its own. Although Mercer had never been brought before any notary, the Sheriff's Office filed a sworn affidavit stating that she did not identify the driver. Although she might, quote, if I see him again, and significantly change in other facts. See that notarized signature, she asked me? That's not my signature either. I saw my name with a big A like this. She produced a pen and wrote her name for me. It was clear that the signature the Dallas Sheriff's Office had on its altered statement was not even close to hers.
Thank you to HelloFresh for sponsoring this episode, and I am such a HelloFresh addict at this point that even if with all these things they want me to say, I would say half of them anyway.
But anyway, yeah, the main key witness in the trial was this dude, Perry Russo from Baton Rouge, who was just like an insurance salesman or something. But he testified that he went to some kind of anti-Castro hangout at Ferry's apartment, David Ferry's apartment, where he saw Leon Oswald, a.k.a. Lee Harvey Oswald, and like I said, Clem Bertrand, who was Clay Shaw, and they all talked about killing JFK together and how there was going to be, quote, triangulation of crossfire and fake alibis and all this stuff. Anyway, Ferry said that he never met Oswald in his life, never talked to him, never interacted with him or anything. But just to give a little credit to all these people who said they saw them together, here is a real fucking verified picture of them together, Ferry and Oswald, serving in the New Orleans Civil Air Patrol in 1955. Dead ass. You can see,
dead ass.
You can see Ferry second from left, and Oswald is on the far right in the back, unmistakably.
I'm going to have to believe you on that because I don't know what these guys look like other than like, Oswald kind of looks like, but I don't know what this other guy looks like.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you.
He looks like a dork with a white T-shirt on. I mean, and that's
there's a lot of them. There's a lot of a lot of dudes in white T-shirts.
This is a well-established photograph. This is very much actually them. I believe. But yeah, once Ferry was fingered as a conspirator in Garrison's case, he got really upset at one of Garrison's aides, Lou Ivan, over the phone, and he was quoted as saying, "You know what this news story does to me, don't you? I'm a dead man. From here on, believe me, I'm a dead man." And less than a week after the details of Garrison's investigation broke in the New Orleans State's item on February 22nd, 1967,
Ferry was found dead in his apartment, and according to the coroner, it was because he had a cerebral hemorrhage due to a congenital intracranial berry aneurysm at the base of his brain. That means he was born with it. That's what congenital means. Weirdly, though, despite it being a random defect that he'd had since birth, they also found two typed notes in his apartment, one that started with, quote, "To leave this life is, for me, a sweet prospect," and ended with, "All the state needs is evidence to support a conviction. If this is justice, then justice be damned." And then another letter in which he left all his possessions to his best friend, Al Bo Buff, which started, quote, "When you read this, I will be quite dead and no answer will be possible," and ended with the words, "As you sowed, so shall you reap." Some people say this sounds less like a suicide note and more like the words of someone who knows people are coming for him. But I don't know what you guys think. But that's pretty weird to have that in your apartment if you died of a congenital berry aneurysm in your brain. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Less than a week after you've been fingered as the guy who's going to be in this trial. Pretty weird. Also, another witness Garrison was trying to get a statement from, anti-Castro Cuban congressman in exile, Eladio Del Valle, was brutally tortured before being shot point blank in the heart and left with an axe wedged in his skull on the same day that David Ferry was found dead, who he allegedly knew personally and even firebombed sugar fields together with in Cuba. So think what you will about Garrison, but those are some pretty weird deaths. And speaking of weird deaths, here's 40 through 45. Weird deaths.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
First death we're going to talk about is Dorothy Kilgallen. She was a reporter for the New York Evening Journal who competed with two other New York paper reporters in a race around the world using publicly available transport in 1936. She started the Voice of Broadway column and radio show in the New York Journal American in 1938, ran for almost 30 years. She's famous for like jeopardizing and destroying her personal friendship with Frank Sinatra in 1948 by publishing a huge front page feature on him. And in 1956, probably most popularly, she was famous for serving as one of the panelists on What's My Line for 15 years. So she's one of the, she's one of the panelists on there. However, she was also very publicly at odds with the Warren Report in her belief that Kennedy was assassinated as the result of a conspiracy and vowed to keep prying into the case until she broke it, starting with being the only reporter in America allowed to have a private interview with Jack Ruby. So she's the only reporter ever who's granted permission to talk to him in private, and nobody knew anything that Ruby said to her. And she said that she was about to blow the whole thing wide open in her new book. But then, unfortunately, on November 8th, 1965, she was found dead at home in the bed of her beautiful Manhattan townhouse, overdosed on alcohol and barbiturates, with no sign of violence or suicide. It was ruled as likely accidental. However, this didn't square with the fact that she was discovered with about 15 to 20 pills worth of a mixture of Nembutal, Secanol, and Tuinol in her system, which would have really fucked her up to try and take on her own in those amounts. And it was extra strange because she had been seen totally chill and in a coherent state very shortly before her death. Also, she was in the master bedroom, which was like a red flag for her friends because she was not in a loving relationship with her husband and she would never sleep in that bed. And she wasn't in her usual pajamas. She was in like a blue bed jacket over a nightgown, which is like a very fancy dress for her. She also had her makeup on and her false eyelashes on, which she never wore to bed. And there was a book on her nightstand that she had set there like she had just been reading it, even though it was a book that she had already read and talked about with her friends. And also she needed reading glasses to read, but none of those, like there was no reading glasses anywhere. There's no vomiting, no any mess, nothing like that. It's like she was cleaned up and placed there almost. Also, unsurprisingly, her JFK notes were gone. And the friend she gave backups to, another journalist called Flo Pritchett, was found dead 2 days later of a cerebral hemorrhage, most likely resulting from her battle with late-stage leukemia that she was fighting. But also, her copy of her notes was also gone. It's just weird timing. What happened to those notes?
Incredibly strange.
Pretty weird. That's some pretty weird stuff. Also, next weird death.
I mean, it is. It's very conspiratorially also like convenient.
Yeah. Next weird death is Lee Bowers. Bowers was a witness to the assassination who had the rare distinction of watching from above since he was operating the Union Terminal Company's two-story interlocking tower at that time, which overlooked the parking lot north of the grassy knoll. He said he saw two men standing near the fence there at the knoll at the time of the shooting, and that he saw some sort of flash of light or smoke coming from near where the men were standing as the motorcade went by. During his questioning by the Warren Commission, he was cut off mid-sentence by the lawyer he was talking to as he began describing, quote, something out of the ordinary, and friends of his, along with his minister, had said he was afraid to discuss everything he saw with the people who questioned him. In fact, here's some of the testimony we do have from him for Mathis to read. And why don't you guys listen to what Mathis says right now, and then you tell me if he sounds like he was coached to specifically say he saw nothing incriminating. You tell me how this sounds to you.
Okay. These two men were standing back from the street, somewhat at the top of the incline, and were very near two trees which were in the area. And one of them, from time to time, as he walked back and forth, disappeared behind a wooden fence, which is also slightly to the west of that. These two men, to the best of my knowledge, were standing there at the time of the shooting. Now I could see back or the south side of the wooden fence in the area. So that obviously there was no one there who could have had anything to do with either as accomplice or anything else, because there was no one there at the moment that the shots were fired.
So super, super confident first part. And then he's like, oh, yeah, and then also this. And that means that nobody that I was looking at could have ever done anything. They couldn't have been an accomplice. They couldn't have been anything at the time the shots were fired. And I know that for sure. Like, it just hits the ear strangely.
Well, yeah, for sure. Jesse, you've been like cackling down there. Is there like something on your mind?
No, it's just we're in the weeds now. This we're is deep. The part of the yes. whole oh, thing yeah. that's just like, you know, it
everybody's a suspect.
Yeah, it's because as people try to withhold information, you know, like going back to the very, very beginning, I was thinking about this then, and I've still been thinking about it, just even going back to Kennedy's head and the idea of his head and the doctors and everyone operating, like, there could even be simple explanations of like, dude, it's the president. We don't want photos of the president with a giant hole in his head existing. Yeah. So let's manipulate this so that's not a thing that will ever happen. Right? Like things like people could have good intentions. Those good intentions lead to, you know, the murkiness of the situation. And that murkiness then devolves into, well, we have no answers, so let's create answers. And then those fake answers spawn other fake answers, spawn other fake answers, spawn theories, then conspiracies, then all these different things. And then everyone has a thing to say, and everyone adds to it. And now suddenly we are like caught in the swamp of disinformation. And it's like, all right, well, is this person saying it because it's what's happened or because they want to be involved in the circus of the whole thing? And it's like, we're officially in that part where it's like, everyone's saying a thing and I trust none of it. I'm like,
And when you get this to bounce off that, when you get this deep into the weeds, there's no longer room for coincidences when the world itself is filled with them all the fucking time. And now, but when you get this deep in, everything is intentional. Nothing is a coincidence. Everybody that looks suspicious is involved on some deep governmental level.
And the problem with that and with most conspiracy is no matter what someone says to counter the conspiracy, there is a counter to that.
Yeah, there's always a way to
keeps going. It cycles over and over and over and over again. So if I were to tell you that the government planned it and you said, well, actually, here's a study that says that they did not, I would say, well, who paid for that study? The government? Like that kind of, it just keeps going. There's no winning.
You have to, it's that whole idea. And we're not, by the way, Alex, we're just not to tangent off of this.
No, this is what I want.
It's like, when it comes to conspiracy theories, the government has to both be all knowing and all powerful, much like any fascist or cult like idea where the government is all powerful and capable of doing all these things, but so sloppy that it's so easy to see as long as you know the truth.
Absolutely.
And it's like, they do not, there's no core, you can't coexist in that way. Like, it's impossible. Like, every enemy has to be the strongest enemy and yet the weakest enemy at the same time.
It's true.
Look, it's the same idea.
It is the exact same thing as when people say, I do not believe Joe Biden is the president. It is all a cover up. It's all a thing. Donald Trump is the president. Also, gas prices are the president's fault.
Right.
Oh, you mean the fake president? Yeah,
fake president is not actually Joe Biden? In control, but he's in control of just enough that he can do these things. It's all but not set up. Enough.
It's like that sort of disassociation where it's like you can't have it both ways. It's got to be one of the other people.
Only way. It's the only way it makes sense for the, when you get this deep, it's like when you get this deep and you're somebody who truly believes that, you know, they're in the truth and they're not in the weeds, to get out of that is like triple the amount of work.
Yeah, 100%.
You're so deep. You have to undo years and craziness and accept that the world is chaos sometimes and coincidences and shit like that are going to happen and not everything is a conspiracy, which is scarier for a lot of people to be like,
yeah, people like I'm at the whim nice little of chaos. Bows or like wrapped up in a nice little package. Done. We have our answers. Let's move on. Which again is why in ages past, religion was much more prevalent because it gave you the nice wrapped up package. It was easy. And now as there's more and more science, more and more people are like, well, I don't know that religion is the answer, but now they're like science is the answer. Who knows?
Yep.
1,000 years from now, what it will maybe like future science, like old science. That's for idiots. Future science.
And it's not even it's not even about just serious stuff either. Like people are like, every July for the last 3 years, Nintendo has announced the new Switch. So that means that a new Switch is coming out this week. You know, like
it's Lydia. It's everything. Everything in the world you can look at. It's what like is looking that at thing called? Is it numerology where you look at numbers and find patterns that aren't there and
JFK,
do all the
QAnon guys?
The thing we talked about. Exactly. That whole like they're doing the numbers and the math, and that proves because the because the world is geometry and reality isn't real and everything is a pattern.
Yeah. But what is true?
Then you then you dissolve into numbers when you smoke too much weed.
Indeed. And what is true though is that Lee Bowers died, and it might not surprise you to hear that he died in August of 1966 in what was officially said to be, quote, a one car accident on a long, open, lonely stretch of road near Midlothian, Texas. But that also there were eyewitness reports of another car running him off the road. This claim was investigated by Texas Highway Patrol officer Charles Good, and he concluded that it was possible that a car run him off the road. And also, perhaps more importantly, Bowers was not killed on impact, and when emergency workers arrived, he was alive. And when he was talking to emergency workers, he used some of the last moments that he had on Earth to tell them that he thought he'd been drugged when he stopped to get coffee a few miles back. It's a pretty weird death. Next weird death goes to Mary Pinchot, Mary Pinchot Meyer. I don't know how to pronounce it. I'm so sorry. She was a painter and journalist.
You're doing your best.
Pinchot. She was a painter and a journalist who was married to CIA agent Cord Meyer from 1945 to 1958, but after that became much more important to history as one of President John F. Kennedy's many and possibly most serious and emotionally invested extramarital relationship, according to those who ran in circles with them. And that's a pretty well-established thing. Like, if you go to this person's Wikipedia entry, like, that's the main thing, is that they were very involved together. Like, it's... This is not a
JFK
fringe theory.
JFK liked to bone down. Just keep that in mind. Yeah. He was a bony boy.
This was not a fringe theory. They were involved together. After Kennedy's death, like Kilgallen, she was just absolutely sure a conspiracy had taken place, claiming to friends that it was Cuban exiles and the mafia working with elements within the CIA who killed him, and that she knew this 100% for sure for a fact. However, less than a year after the assassination, on October 12th, 1964, during her post-painting walk alongside the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal towpath, she was approached by a, quote, black man in a light jacket, dark slacks, and a dark cap, who fired two point-blank 38 caliber bullets, one into her back and one into her temple, in a manner consistent with a killer, quote, highly trained in the use of firearms. Originally, a man called Ray Crump was brought in as the suspect, and it went all the way to trial, because he was wet and he was like in the area and his pants were pulled down and some guy saw him. Some guy saw a black guy trailing her the day before who was running, some army guy. But he was eventually acquitted since he didn't really match the description the person witnesses saw. He was like 50 pounds heavier or something than those people. And later in a book, his attorney revealed far after the fact that he was actually having sex with someone just before the murder, and there was a very well-established alibi for that, but that the woman that he was with wouldn't testify because she didn't want to get in trouble with her husband. It's pretty crazy. This murder is a whole situation. There are multiple books just about this murder, and there's way more to get into here, including that guy who was jogging and who saw, who he said was Crump,
he had the same name as the operational code name that was essentially like supposedly used by the real assassin here, William L. Mitchell. Apparently that might have been the real assassin, was that guy jogging. But here's a quote from one of these books about this case called Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney for Jesse to read. I'm going to drop that into the Zoom chat here for you.
Former killers who had been in the cleaning business for the CIA have openly talked about it and revealed that it was done exactly how it looks like it was done. That they had one of our cleaning men nail her down by the towpath while she was out for her daily jog. She was eliminated because she knew too much.
Bam. Less than a year after.
Easy.
Yeah. Our president's girlfriend, moited. Next weird death is Sam Giancana, a heavy-duty mobster who was literally the actual boss of the Chicago outfit from 1957 to 1966, tippy-tippy-top, and whose house and activities were under 24-hour FBI surveillance to the point that he was known to tease them and give them shit on the golf course as they followed him around. He was so used to having this surveillance on him at all times. Some sources name him as partially responsible for Kennedy's victory in the 1960 presidential election. And during a CIA plot to assassinate Fidel Castro, he was recruited along with a few other mobsters like Santo Traficante Jr. and Carlos Marcello into an op that may have lasted all the way up to and included the Kennedy assassination itself. We know for sure that this op was real. We do not know that it went all the way up to the Kennedy assassination. But he was hired by the CIA for real. Anyway, he served 1 year in prison in 1965 after being convicted of contempt of court. Then he ran off to Cuernavaca, Mexico for 8 years before being deported back to Oak Park, Illinois, where he was eventually murdered on June 19th, 1975. And here's a quote from Mathis to read from JFK, The Dead Witnesses by Craig Roberts and John Armstrong. That's going to give you a little...
They're going to say this is a quote from dead JFK. And I was like, how do you do that?
He's like, I like the green stone.
All right. That night, while cooking in the kitchen of his Chicago home, which was described by many as a fortress or bunker, Giancana came under the gun. According to both his daughter and the police, who stated that Giancana was invulnerable in his own home due to the security systems and impregnability of the structure, only someone who knew or trusted could have gotten to him. Giancana would have let them in, gone back to cooking, and then been surprised when the assailant or assailants pulled a .22 pistol.
He was shot once in the back of the head and a few more times through the chin while he was cooking in the basement, and nobody knows who did it, but it is true that at the time he was scheduled to testify before a Senate committee specifically looking into mafia involvement in a failed CIA plot to assassinate Castro, which, like I said, could have possibly revealed connections to part of the Kennedy situation that certain government agencies didn't want becoming public knowledge. Check out this timeline from the book about this murder. Tell me what you think. June 19th, 1975, members of the Senate's Church Committee arrive in Chicago for the express purpose of escorting Sam Giancana to Washington for his appearance before the committee. At 9 p.m. that night, two, quote, law enforcement officers, end quote, are observed outside Sam Giancana's home by his neighbors in Oak Park, a wealthy suburb of Chicago. 9 p.m. At 11:15 p.m. that night, three surveillance cars reportedly leave the area of Sam Giancana's home. 15 minutes later, at 11:30 p.m., Sam Giancana is murdered inside his home. The next day, June 20th, 1975, the Chicago Tribune reports the murder of Sam Giancana, and allegations are made that the murder was sanctioned by the CIA. But then, the next day after that, June 21st, 1975, the Chicago Tribune reports that Giancana's house was under surveillance on the night that he was killed, even though we know that they left 15 minutes before he was murdered. And if that's not enough, less than 2 months later, the body of another Chicago mobster set to testify before the same committee, John Handsome Johnny Roselli, was found chopped up and floating in an oil drum in Dumfoundling Bay near Miami, Florida, like in August of that year. So just a few months later. And if that's not a weird
death. Unfortunate way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
If that's not a weird death, I don't know what is. Now let's move on to 46 through 48. The end, parentheses of episode one. There's not much left I want to share from this book. But before I do, I just want to point out that there is a lot more in this book that I haven't covered. But again, it all centers around a theory that I don't really subscribe to. The book is not very well researched, or at least very well cited. But again, it all centers around a theory, CIA, FBI, mafia, Cuba kind of theory, So I'd rather approach some of the stuff in those last 15 reasons that Governor Ventura gives from other angles. So if you,
out of curiosity, in future episodes, are we going to cover mob or mafia angles?
Yeah, I just don't want to do it following Governor Jesse Ventura.
I'm just curious because it's another wildly interesting side of things. Have you ever watched like Vlad or something on YouTube where he does interviews with like
I've seen so much shit. I've been going deep.
Okay, cool. All right, continue. Yeah, sorry.
I'm gonna get into that stuff, but I don't want to do it through this way because he kind of fudges stuff sometimes, and I've been having to unfudge it as I go. Yeah. If you want to keep going down Jesse Ventura's rabbit hole, grab the book yourself. It's easy to get, doesn't cost very much. But before we go, a last few things I would categorize as big revelations with no real conclusions. In June of 1997, 33 years after the Warren Commission, 40,000 pages of records belonging to the commission's chief counsel, J. Lee Rankin, were made public by the Assassination Record Review Board, and it revealed a bombshell piece of info involving yet another American president, eventual American president. Here's an abridged version of that article for Jesse to read. It's from the Associated Press. I'm going to give you a little quotey boy. Let me see if I can get it in here. Nope, it's going in Twitter.
Okay. 33 years ago, Gerald R. Ford took pen in hand and changed ever so slightly the Warren Commission's key sentence on the place where the bullet entered John F. Kennedy's body when he was killed in Dallas. The effect of Ford's change was to strengthen the commission's conclusion that a single bullet passed through Kennedy and severely wounded Texas Governor John Connally, a crucial element in its findings that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole gunman. "This is the most significant lie in the whole Warren Commission report," said Robert D. Morningstar, a computer system specialist in New York City, who said he has studied the assassination since it occurred and written an internet book about it. The effect of Ford's editing, Morningstar said, was to suggest that a bullet struck Kennedy in the neck, raising the wound 2 or 3 inches. Without that alteration, they could never have hoodwinked the public as to the true number of assassins. If the bullet had hit Kennedy in the back, it could not have struck Connally in the way the commission said it did, he said. Here's the thing. Look, I don't want to have to say this, but I'm going to say it. Anyone can get a book published these days. And if you got to be an internet published person,
this is a 90s. That's what I'm saying. This is a 90s.
You
got to
be internet published in the 90s. None of what you said is true.
Was it angelfire.com/web /Kennedy
assassination?
This is an edited article from the Associated Press. Like, this is a fact checked article, right?
Fair. It is AP. Yeah. It is the AP.
But yeah, so that's the thing. That's one big thing I think is worth knowing. Just like, wow, he literally just moved it. And when they asked him about it, he was like, "I was just doing it for clarity. I wasn't trying to cover up anything. I just did it for clarity." So he really did do it. He really admitted that he did it. You know what I mean? Gerald Ford. Another thing that I think is worth knowing about is a technique for getting the answer that you want from somebody that you're interviewing. And it's called say now, prove later. Where the idea is asking someone a question about something that will be proved later really limits what they can actually say as an answer to that question. They can basically just say, you just ask somebody, if this is true, is this true? And you're like,
what?
Yes. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm going to have Mathis read you guys a quote from Arlen Specter, the guy who invented the magic bullet theory, the guy who like brought that out in the Warren Commission. Mathis, you're going to read a line of questioning that this guy did. And you tell me if this is a chill way to ask a question.
All right, I'm ready.
It's going in Twitter. Okay, this is just one question, by the way.
This is one question. All right, it's loading. Here we go. "Permit me to add some fact, which I shall ask you to assume as being true for purposes of having you expressed an opinion. First of all, assume that the president was struck by a 6.5 millimeter copper jacketed bullet from a rifle having a muzzle velocity of approximately 2,000 feet per second at the time when the president was approximately 160 to 200 feet from the weapon, with the president being struck from the rear at the downward angle of approximately 45 degrees, being struck in the upper right posterior thorax, just above the upper border of the scapula, 14 centimeters from the tip of the right acromion process, and 14 centimeters below the tip of the right mastoid process. That was one sentence, everybody. Jesus
assume
Christ.
That. Assume and that. Still more. Assume that.
And now, can I just immediately tell you, this is how Ben Shapiro talks. This is literally Ben Shapiro's way of answering questions or asking questions. Assume further that the missile passed through the body of the president, striking no bones, traversing the neck and sliding between the muscle and the posterior aspect of the president's body through a fascia channel without violating the pleural cavity, but bruising only the apex of the right pleural cavity and bruising the most apical portion of the right lung, then causing a hematoma to the right of the larynx, which you have described, and creating a jagged wound in the trachea, then exiting precisely at the point where you observe the puncture wound to exist. Now, based on those facts, was the appearance of the wound, in your opinion, consistent with being an exit wound? What an asshole.
Isn't that insane?
What a piece of garbage.
He's like,
assume this, assume that. This is all fact. Then this would be
he's
true,
like,
right?
He's like, assume my entire theory is true. Is it true?
Like, it's so, I hate people who talk like, if there's no logic there, but you confuse somebody immediately by throwing that much out there. And if you're constantly saying, assume, 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 then obviously what you're trying to get to at the end is me to say, yes.
Yeah. And that's pretty much a thematic theme for this entire JFK investigation is like that feeling. Fighting against that feeling. And finally, I have one last thing I'm going to read myself. But before I do, I just want to say thanks to everybody for sticking with me, Chilluminati rules, and that I promise I'll make good on every last promise I've made real soon. Also, I'm going to be starting a big post with every link, clip, and image I still have for every Chilluminati script I've ever written. And I'm going to update it from now on for every new episode that I make as well. Just links and images and pictures. Look for it soon on r/Chilluminati pod. It's not the Patreon. That's the official slogan for that. Anyway, this next quote is not going to be on that post. Here we go.
Yeah, I'm ready.
A sinister dark presence
God
in a haunted
you.
Cottage.
God damn you.
A bell that rings by itself. A priceless, ancient jewel protected by a terrible curse. This is the true story of a paranormal investigation that went horribly wrong. It is March 1982. As the last snows of winter fall, a seance is held at the Parasearch headquarters. The psychics involved experience a remarkable vision of a red gemstone, the priceless Stop. Eye of fire, taken from the hilt of King Arthur's legendary sword, Excalibur.
No,
but at the height of the meeting, a strange presence unexpectedly appears in a corner of the darkened room, bringing a sudden and terrifying end to the evening. Now the investigation is plagued by the evil dark figure. To find the stone, they must solve the riddle of the old bell in the ruined abbey. But in the attempt, they release a terrible curse which protects the ancient red jewel. So the hunters become the hunted. Their search becomes a matter of life or death as the desperate bid to find the stone soars to a horrifying climax coming soon.
They have to find the opposite, How the green stone, to protect you. Themselves from the red stone. I don't know, man. This is crazy.
There's a red
Are
stone.
Are you in control next week?
There's a red stone. I'm done. You. I'm done. JFK episode one, done. Whatever is
cool. Coming. So what? In my control next week, then.
Yeah, whatever's coming
you know
next.
What? No, okay, no, cool. You know what? No. I'm going to take over.
Okay, all right. Jesse episode nonsense. Next week.
I'm tired of this nonsense.
Well, I was just going to talk about another murder.
No. I'm tired of this. I'll handle it. I'll handle it.
All right. Next week, a Jesse episode, everybody. And what a first opening volley of the JFK series to continue on in 2022 as we get further along. I'm excited
to see
where it goes.
Team Redstone, who's in it? Let us know.
I'm going to go. I got to go with OG Green. OG I got to stick with Team Green. I'm going with Team Greenstone. I'm calling it now. Jesse, what about you?
I mean, Team Greenstone. Always.
Excellent. I'm going to go. One day we will see Michael Raparez on this show one more time at some point.
I'm gonna go for the hat trick. I'll see you guys next time.
All right, goodbye, everybody. Well, we're going to patreon.com/JulianMinotiPod. We're going to go do a mini-sode. Anyway, bye.
Me and my wife were sitting outside indulging on our porch one night, enjoying ourselves. I needed to go to the bathroom, so I stepped back inside, and after a few moments, I hear my wife go, "Holy shit, get out here." So I quickly dash back outside, and she's looking up at the sky in awe. I look up, too, and there's a perfect line of dozen lights traveling across the sky.